Yaha. Hu Daksha. Etat Marcham. This body. Udisha. With reference to Bhagavati. To Shiva. Aprati Druhi. Who is not envious. Druyati. Bears envy. Agyaha. Less intelligent persons. Vitag Drishtehi. The vision of duality. Tatvataha. From transcendental knowledge. Vimukkaha. Bereft. Bhavet. May become. Translation. Anyone who has accepted Daksha as the most important personality and neglected Lord Shiva because of envy is less intelligent, and because of visualizing in duality will be bereft of transcendental knowledge. So you can repeat. Anyone who has accepted Daksha.
Anyone who has accepted Daksha.
As the most important personality.
As the most important personality.
And neglected Lord Shiva.
Because of envy.
Is less intelligent. And because of visualizing in duality. Will be bereft of transcendental knowledge. A purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. The first curse by Mandishara was that anyone supporting Daksha was foolishly identifying himself with the body. And therefore, because Daksha had no transcendental knowledge, supporting him would deprive one of transcendental knowledge. Daksha, Nandishara said, identified himself with the body like other materialistic persons and was trying to derive all kinds of facilities in relationship with the body. He had excessive attachment for the body, and in relation to the body, with a wife, children, home, and others such things, which are different from the soul. Therefore, Nandishara's curse was that anyone who supported Daksha would be bereft of transcendental knowledge of the soul, and thus also be deprived of knowledge of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Ayaitan marcham udishya bhagavatya prati druhi druhatyagya pratag drishtis tatvato vimukho bhavet. So, Om Ganatim Dandasha, Granjana Shilakaya Chakshur, Unmiritam Yena Tasmai, Shi Gurave Namaha. So, actually, what is going on here is actually a microcosm of the macrocosm. That's interesting. So, microcosm means like a small sample, the macrocosm means the whole world like that, or something bigger. So, which is a conflict between ritualistic religion and spontaneous religion, or, you know, something from the heart, religion from the heart, which is really interesting, because this goes on all over the place. This is not just between Daksha and Lord Shiva, because Daksha is your typical, quintessential, that's an interesting word, Daksha is your quintessential ritualistic brahmana. Because the word Daksha means he's expert. So he's expert. What is he expert in? Of course, we know from previous discussions that Daksha is expert in having children. Well, it doesn't require a lot of training for that stuff. Prabhupada actually comments that you don't have to instruct a young boy how to become attracted to a young girl or vice versa. You know, not that you have to have lessons in these things. I mean, what you have to have in school is lessons in how to prevent, let's say, unnecessary pregnancy and things like that, isn't it? That's what you need in school, not lessons how to be attracted. You know, you don't have a teacher say, when you see this particular type of person with these particular type of physical characteristics, you should respond like this. It's not that there has to be, let's say, a vaidhi, you know, practice. So So they have like a role playing in the class where the teachers put the students in a practice situation. All right, here's a girl, here's a boy, you know. What are you supposed to say? You know, what are you supposed to do? What are you supposed to look at? You know, you don't need practice. It's all spontaneous. Anyway, so Doctor really didn't need practice in that sort of stuff. So, in other words, every living entity may be expert in that stuff. But as far as the ritualistic Brahmana aspect, I mean, Daksha was definitely very expert. And in fact, that's why it was his sacrifice here. You know, Daksha was in charge of the sacrifice because he knew all the different mantras and the mudras and the, you know, whatever other else goes in the sacrifice, you know, what type of wood to be used. Just like the other day, Mahamantra and Goloka Anupriya came to me and said, we have a fire sacrifice, and, you know, what type of wood should we use? And I said, I don't know. It's good. Of course, you're supposed to use a Rani wood. I know that. But, you know, where are you going to find that in North Carolina? So I said, just find some dry wood. Because wet wood smokes. You know, that's all I know about wood, you know. Wet wood smokes. And I know the difference between hardwood and softwood. You know, pine, if you burn pine, then you get all this creosote. And if you burn, a nice thing is cedar. Cedar heck gives off a nice smell, but then they said, well, the Brahmana said you shouldn't use cedar because it's not auspicious. Anyway, so whatever. So Daksha means someone who's expert, like in the wood you use, the direction you face. I mean, Prabhupada himself admitted he wasn't so expert in all those things. Prabhupada said, if you want to find out about all these details, just go ask my godbrothers. In other words, it's not that Prabhupada really wanted us like dealing so much with his godbrothers, but Prabhupada actually was indicating these things are not that important. You understand the rituals. On the other hand, of course, then we're referring, of course, to the two tracks of devotional service, Bhagavad Vidhi and Pancharatriki Vidhi. Pancharatriki Vidhi is like the rituals and temple worship, but you can't neglect that completely, nor did Prabhupada neglect it completely. But the most important thing is the Bhagavad Vidhi. Bhagavad Vidhi means like what Lord Shiva is engaged in. Chanting, hearing, devotional service, being merciful to other living entities. That's all Bhagavad Vidhi. Reading Srimad Bhagavatam, philosophy. Pancharatriki Vidhi is the regulation of the temple worship. You know, this regulation, get up early. So, of course, Prabhupada said we shouldn't neglect Pancharatriki Vidhi. But at the same time, the Bhagavad Vidhi is more important. So Lord Shiva is practically only engaged in Bhagavad Vidhi. You understand? But if one gets too much into the Pancharatriki Vidhi, neglecting the Bhagavad Vidhi, then they become like ritualistic, very ritualistic. Like we find Daksha. I mean, Daksha was a devotee. It's not that Daksha is a demon or anything like that. I mean, he did some things that were could be considered demoniac, such as offending Vaishnavas. That's a demoniac action. Demoniac means not conducive to fulfilling his need to connect with Krishna. Let's define demoniac in that way. So anyway, Daksha did things that were not conducive for his spiritual life, but he was a devotee. There's no doubt about it. He was actually a devotee. He saw Vishnu. I mean, Hare Krishna, probably a lot more elevated than the rest of us. But Daksha was very much into these rituals. So it's actually quite an interesting thing because we were talking about the microcosm and the macrocosm. So you'll find this occurs in practically every single religion that there is in the beginning, you know, everything is spontaneous. You know, you have a founder who is really cool. I'm using that word, not in a joking sense, I guess, but in a really nice sense. You know, you have a founder who's really like spontaneous, like Prabhupada, and who also does Pancharatriki stuff, but, you know, mainly interested in, you know, spontaneous devotional service and preaching and everything like that, like Prabhupada, book distribution and everything. Or Lord Jesus Christ, isn't it? And generally, the founder of these particular religions is sort of rebelling, or not necessarily rebelling, but at least not taking so seriously the ritualistic aspects of the religion. In fact, that's probably why he's so successful. not why he's empowered by God, but probably one of the ingredients for his success. Just like you see Lord Jesus Christ, one of the primary complaints that he had, that the people were giving, was that, you know, he was against the ritualistic stuff. Like, there's the people in Jerusalem called the Sanhedrin, you know, all the priests, or what we call rabbis, rabbis, rebbe, rebel. Anyway, so they were very much into all their rituals, and actually they were doing animal slaughter and everything like that. You could, at the doorway to the main temple in Jerusalem, there was not only the money changing, but you could buy your lambs for slaughter. Can you imagine that? You know, there were actually people selling lambs for slaughter right at the doorway. And so, you know, you change your money, buy some lambs, cut the throat, do your sacrifice, etc. So, you know, Jesus Christ did things like turning over the tables of the money changers. Poor money changers. You have to have empathy for them. I definitely have empathy for them. Anyway, so, just like going against all this ritual stuff and just being really, you know, just spontaneous in his devotion. Just preach and leave everything behind and go to the forest. Isn't it like that? Or go to the desert. Wasn't too much forest there. Isn't it? No, there weren't too many forest dwellers in that part of the world. Because it's all desert area. You know, you go to the forest. Anyway, so you find all the founders of the religions, they generally went places like either to the forest or to the mountains, to live in caves, or to the desert. Well, even Moses, he went to the desert, you know. You know, you just find this common denominator there, isn't it? He probably came to the west. Anyways, which is sort of a desert in many ways, which we won't comment on. So, they were in opposition to these ritualistic Brahmins, the Daksha people. You know, so now we're speaking about the macrocosm. So the Daksha people, you know, Daksha people means they're expert, you know, doing all the rituals, the big buildings and everything like that. But in essence, after some time, those big buildings and what's going on in the big buildings represents a loss of the original spirit of the religion. Actually, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur commented, and he said, practically speaking, there's never been an organization where the original spirit of the religion has not been lost. He's talking about, you know, organization. Of course, he attempted to form an organization because at the same time, you cannot spread your religion or involve more people in your particular spirituality unless you actually have an organization. So there's this tension there. You got to have an organization. Because what happens if you don't have an organization and everything just goes on, you know, spontaneously, then you end up like Lord Shiva's followers. And Lord Shiva's followers are so interesting because there's so many different varieties of Lord Shiva's followers, and they're rather, I mean, if you really like Halloween, you probably would be interested in this. Halloween. Just like last night, I was at someone's house and I was mentioning Halloween, and the kids had never been exposed to the ghoulish aspect of Halloween. They just think you dress up as Jimmy Carter and George Bush. But actually, that Halloween is a celebration of the mode of ignorance, you know, basically speaking. Everyone thinks it's cool, you know, dress up. I remember when I was young, I dressed up as the Invisible Man. You know, I took some Ace bandage. You know what Ace bandage is? I think the doctors know it. And I wrapped it all around my body. And I went out like that. Any of you remember that Invisible Man TV show? You know, it was a guy that when he wanted to do anything, he would take his Ace bandage off. And he would walk around naked, but invisible, so nobody would see that he was naked. So, anyone ever see that? Yeah. So, so we were talking about, anyway, Halloween. So Halloween's All Souls Night, you know, like Anyway, so it's just a gruesome thing. I mean, many of the celebrations that people have are just really ignorant celebrations, like Carnival or something like that in Brazil. Isn't it? Just horrible, gruesome. So, more vigorous. So anyway, so what happens is Lord Shiva's followers, you know, because generally in the Shastras it talks about how they're ghosts and goblins and everything like that, but it manifests in a very interesting way in India. What? What's that? Not loud enough? Okay. Hare Bo. Wake up, sleeping souls. Life is meant not just for eating and cooking. Anyway, so... eat austerely and be happy. Anyway, so it manifests in a very interesting way in India, because you have Lord Shiva's followers who are doing things like eating out of skulls, which is really interesting, you know. Human skulls. We're not talking about, you know, clam shells or something like that. But they actually take human skulls and they walk around. You ever see that? Pictures. And they put their prasadam, whether it's prasadam or not, that's another question. But they put their food inside skulls. Can you imagine that? Can you, like a Sunday feast, you know, everybody brings their skull out. Have you washed your skull out properly? Don't contaminate your skull. You know, go to the sink and wash your skull out, dear. So anyway, so they... imagine what it's like with a whole meeting of these people, you know, when they have a convention. It would be quite interesting, you know. Anyway, so they eat from skulls, they smear ashes on their body, they walk around, you know, you have like the Nagababas, of course, and I'm sure everyone's seen the Nagababas if you've been in India. They're even in Mayapur and other places. So you have all these really interesting followers of Lord Shiva, and that's what happens when you don't have some regulation. You understand? So it gets really wild after a while. Yeah, you know, rainbow gathering, you know, love, freedom, like that. So this it gets extremely wild. So you need some regulation. Whereas on the other hand, this is actually quite an interesting sociological dynamic. On the other hand is when you have regulation, then ultimately we see that the organization loses the spirit. I mean, let's take the Christianity, for example. You have, of course, you have the Catholic Church, which is really, like, regulated and everything like that, and then they get really into their rituals in the Vatican. And then you had the people who sort of, like the monks who went off into the forest and everything like that, and they formed their particular organizations. Then their organizations got really, you know, hierarchical, stratified, and... I mean, let's take St. Francis. Okay, he's a cool guy. St. Francis, Prabhupada said, was Brahman realized because he was considering, he was Krishna conscious, considering like different entities, like the animals, different animals and plants to be like his brothers and sisters. So you take St. Francis. So he formed, of course, the Franciscan monk order, you understand? And they had started up monasteries. But it's interesting, they became so stratified that later on they kicked him out of his Franciscan monastery because he was just too, you know, too much into Krishna consciousness. It was just really interesting, isn't it? It's really interesting how these things go like that. The organization sort of saps the essence of the religion to begin with, you know, just get into all... I'm not saying we should do away with organization. I'm not speaking anti, you know, GBC or anti... It's got good problem, but one of these things. But at the same time, you got this real tension between, you know, organization or, you know, ritual activity, which you definitely need. I mean, just like now we have, even in ISKCON, we have our deity worship ministry. Before anyone can install deities, they have to consult with the deity worship ministry. Of course, he imposes so many traits in the Sringa Kapacha Prabhu. You know, he freaks people out because he's really into all the details, which is good. I mean, Prabhupada actually said before you install deities, you should have 5 or 6 brahmanas in the temple, etc., like that. But, you know, I'm dealing with that. And actually, in my zone in Croatia, I'm dealing with pray something like that. They just installed Gauranatai deities, big Gauranatai deities in a city called Karlovac, which is, maybe you know that city. You don't know that city. That's near Zagreb. It's about an hour away from Zagreb. You were there, so you know Karlovac. So the devotees just wanted to install them, and they installed them with the idea, well, even if we can't take care of them later, we'll give them to some household that happened this house. And then so you had one extreme there. And you had Nrisimha Kavacha Prabhu just saying, you know, don't put them on the altar, don't worship them. You got to have 10 brahmanas to worship Gauranatai. So that's two extremes there. You got a real interesting tension between both of those things. And then also, especially in the Balkan area, they tend to get really spontaneous. Because one of the devotees there is like, it's just like Narada Muni, you know, one of the main leaders. Yeah, anyway, Satchinanda Maharaj, she's real spontaneous and everything like that, not into the... He's like Lord Shiva, you know, Krishna conscious, like Lord Shiva. And then you have like the other people. It's really interesting, you know, some of the people on the National Council who are like Daksha, so... Yeah. Isn't it? Like, it sounds like Daksha, Dadi Baksha, you know, anyway, right? So I'm not saying criticizing. I mean, they're both all good devotees, but you actually have the tension between both of them, and it's really interesting to watch, because they just, you know, in our temple in Zagreb, they want to put Radha Krishna deities on the altar and install them, even though they don't even have one steady pujari. But the devotee is more or less in the mood of his spiritual master. Yeah, Sundarananda, you know Sundarananda, yeah. He's in, you know, real spontaneous type, but... And you got the members of the National Council who are like on the opposite end of the spectrum just freaking out and saying, writing to me, Maharaj, do something about it. And I'm trying to be friends with everybody. So it's a real challenge. You know, I don't want to burn out anybody. And at the same time, I don't want to be part of committing offenses. But at the same time, I want to spread the movement and have spontaneous devotional service and encourage people. So, you know, how do you do all those things? So in ISKCON, we're put in a very interesting situation that sometimes we have to play both sides of the fence. Anyway, so you see this dynamic going on in every religious organization. I mean, for example, even in ancient India, you had the ritualistic brahmanas who were like Daksha. And then after that, you had, we mentioned this before, the ritualistic brahmanas were actually just so much into their rituals, and they had a monopoly on ritualism, because you had to be born as a brahmin to be a brahmin. And even if you wanted to get bar mitzvahed or anything like that, you had to go to the brahmanas. You know, even in the Jewish religion, it's like that. There's a whole tribe. It's a Kohanim tribe, which one of our devotees is a member of, who now works at, does the brahminical activity of managing an apartment complex. But anyway, so... You understand? There was a whole... India, there's a whole tribe. Maybe you should see if he's watching. Who's controlling? Put it in the video there. Anyway, so you had this whole tribe, and those are the people who are supposed to be the priests, the Levites, isn't it? The Levi, just like Levi jeans. Nope. Put it on the video, so I video, so you can see if anyone's watching. No. Three people, he may be watching. Anyway, so you, not Levi jeans, but the Levi priests, right? Remember that? So it was interesting. You had these people. So also in India, it was like that. It was a very hereditary. Actually, practically in every culture, you actually have these hereditary priests. Even in Europe, it's like that. I mean, even though the priests weren't supposed to get married or have children, they still did in Europe. So they had a caste system in Europe, really had a caste system in Europe. You know, you're born in a blacksmith family, you become a blacksmith, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the caste system was present all over the world. So anyway, so what happened in India, you had these hereditary brahmanas, and everybody was dependent on the brahmanas. The brahmanas were doing their animal sacrifice, just like in... You see parallels in every culture. Just like in ancient Jerusalem, it was like that too, you know. The brahmanas or the Sanhedrin were doing their animal sacrifices. So in India, they were doing animal sacrifices. And so these people who wanted to be spiritual and, you know, wanted sort of like a democratic understanding that anybody could be, you know, Krishna conscious, they rebelled against them, just like Jesus Christ rebelled against the Sanhedrin. And then as a result, then they went to the forest. In India, they actually have forests. They used to have forests before they decimated all the forests. So they went to the forest, and these were called the Shramanas in India, or the forest dwellers, Aranyakas or Shramanas. And they wrote their literatures, you know, the forest dweller literatures, the Brahmin literatures. And so so you had all these itinerant sages there in India in the beginning who were rebelling against the dakshas or the ritualistic Brahmanas. And they ultimately formed their organizations, and their organizations became so stratified and problematic that other people had to rebel against their organizations. It's interesting, isn't it? Someone is just achoo. Someone is sneezing there. The karuna's on, at least. So you understand? It's really interesting. I don't know who's sneezing. Take that part out. I'm not interested in seeing people sneeze. So really, that will happen. And actually, in Europe, also that happened with the Reformation, isn't it? There's the Protestant Reformation, rebelling against the Catholic Church. And then the Protestants, they form their stratified organizations too. Isn't it? Interesting. I was just speaking to one Protestant minister yesterday, and he was just telling me about this. You know, he said, there's nobody's interested in spiritual life here. They're just interested in just doing what they've been doing for the last, you know, few hundred years or whatever in the Baptist church. And he said, even if you do something a little different, they freak out. You know, you can't really raise questions about anything or say anything. What was that question? He said something about Jesus Christ. Anyway, see, he raised one quite philosophical question, just a philosophical discussion, not blasphemous or anything like that. And then everybody got angry with him because they started quoting and yelling at him. And we see that in ISKCON nowadays too, you know, that, isn't it that people bring up philosophical discussions, they bring out quotes of Prabhupada and just bombard the person, try to kill the person with quotes from Prabhupada. Because everything's becoming stratified like that, you know, just like fossilized, so to speak. So it's important for the devotees to understand this particular dynamic, the sociology of religion, so that we don't make the same mistakes, or at least we catch ourselves when we're making the same mistakes that every other religion has made since time immemorial. We should not think, you know, sometimes we in ISKCON think we're so transcendental, we're not subjected to psychology anymore, we're not subjected to sociology. But actually, if you examine ISKCON, it's just the sociology. I'm not talking about the philosophy or the chanting or the process of Krishna consciousness, but what's going on sociologically in ISKCON is it's just like you're a typical, you know, it's just like it's right, it's a textbook case. And what every other organization has gone through at different stages. So you have to understand sociology so you can not be influenced by this. You know, just like we have our conservatives and reform people, or anyway, conservatives and liberals, et cetera, like that. And then later on, we may have several branches of ISKCON, like the conservative, orthodox, reform branches of ISKCON. These things will happen. You know, ISKCON's not different sociologically. It's different. It's different philosophically, and as far as, you know, the devotional practices, because we have more understanding. But in fact, that makes it a little more dangerous because we become prouder. You know, because we have this philosophy, we can defeat any other philosophy. So therefore, we tend to think that we're better than everybody else, and we're not going to be subjected to these particular dynamics. But we will. Believe me, we will. And are being subject to these dynamics. Okay, any questions or comments? We've got about a half second left. Yeah.
So it says how at least Ray was going to curse the followers to not be able to be bereft.
That's right. Because when you get too much into rituals, that's what happens.
Someone actually curse you not to be able to have
it. No, it was already there. He didn't have to curse. You understand? He didn't have to curse. It was already there. But, you know, it's like he had to just reinforce it. He was just saying what was already there. Yeah. They would be bereft of transcendental knowledge. Because someone who gets really into the rituals, they forget about the essence. They forget about the goal of Krishna consciousness. But at the same time, if you neglect the rituals, then you become like the Nagababas. If you neglect any organization, then you become like, then you're going to be eating out of a skull. Or you become wild. You understand? So you, it's real interesting in religion. Anyway, religion generally has to reinvent itself every, you know, few years. Sometimes every few hundred years. Even Krishna even says that in the Gita where he says, you know, that science was lost, therefore I have to instruct it again. But that's the philosophical aspect. But as far as the practical aspect or organizational aspect, it has to be reinvented every, I don't know what it is, every, you know, few years, practically speaking.